Ashenden, W. Somerset Maugham. Chapter 13, The Flip of a Coin. It was high time. Snow had fallen in the morning, but now the sky was clear, and Ashenden, with a glance at the frosty stars, stepped out quickly. He feared that Herbartus, tired of waiting for him, might have gone home. He had, at this interview, to make a certain decision, and the hesitation he felt about it had lurked throughout the evening at the back of his mind like a malaise that had only to become a little more definite to be felt as a pain. For Herbartus, indefatigable and determined, had been engaged in the arrangement of a scheme to blow up certain munition factories in Austria. It's not necessary to give here the details of his plan, but it was ingenious and effective. Its drawback was that it entailed the death and mutilation of a good many Galician Poles, his fellow countrymen, who were working in the factories in question. He had told Ashenden earlier in the day that everything was ready and he had only to give the word. "But please do not give it unless it's essential," he said in his precise, somewhat throaty English. "Of course, we will not hesitate if it is necessary, but we do not want to sacrifice our own people for nothing." "When do you want an answer?" "Tonight. We have got someone who is starting for Prague tomorrow morning." It was then that Ashenden had made the appointment that he was now hurrying to keep. "You'll not be late, will you?" Herbartus had said. "I shall not be able to catch the messenger after midnight." Ashenden had qualms that he was conscious that it would be a relief if, on reaching the hotel, he found that Herbartus had left. That would give him a respite. The Germans had blown up factories in the Allied countries, and there was no reason why they should not be served in the same manner. It was a legitimate act of war. It not only hindered the manufacture of arms and munitions, but also shook the morale of the non-combatants. It was not, of course, a thing that the bigwigs cared to have anything to do with. Though ready enough to profit by the activities of obscure agents of whom they'd never heard, they shut their eyes to dirty work so that they could put their clean hands on their hearts and congratulate themselves that they had never done anything that was unbecoming to men of honor. Ashenden thought with cynical humor of an incident in his relationship with R. He'd been approached with an offer that he thought it was his duty to put before the chief. "By the way," he said to him as casually as possible, "I've got a sportsman who's willing to assassinate King B for £5,000. King B was the ruler of a Balkan state which was on the verge, through his influence, of declaring war against the Allies, and it was evident that his disappearance from the scene would be extremely useful. His successor sympathies were indefinite, and it might be possible to persuade him to keep his country neutral." Ashenden saw from R's quick, intent look that he was perfectly aware of the situation, but he frowned sulkily. "Well, what of it?" "I told him I'd transmit his offer. I believe he's perfectly genuine. He's pro-ally, and he thinks it would about bust his country if it went on the side of the Germans." "What's he want £5,000 for, then?" "It's a risk, and if he does the Allies a good turn, he doesn't see why he shouldn't get something out of it." R shook his head energetically. "It's not the kind of thing we can have anything to do with. We don't wage war by those methods. We leave them to the Germans. Damn it all, we're gentlemen." Ashenden didn't reply, but watched R with attention. There was in his eyes the curious reddish light that they sometimes had and that gave them so sinister an expression. He had always a slight tendency to squint, and now he was quite definitely cross-eyed. "You ought to know better than to put up a proposition like that to me. Why didn't you knock the man down when he made it?" "I didn't think I could," said Ashenden. "He was bigger than I. Besides, it never occurred to me. He was very civil and obliging." "Of course it would be a damn good thing for the Allies if King B were out of the way. I admit that. But between that and countenancing his assassination, there's all the difference between black and white. If a man were a patriot, I should have thought he'd have gone straight ahead and done what he thought right, regardless. He may be thinking of his widow, said Ashenden. Anyhow, it's not a matter I'm prepared to discuss. Different people look at things in different ways, and if anyone thought he was helping the Allies by taking on his own shoulders a heavy responsibility, that's of course entirely his lookout. It took Ashenden a moment to see what his chief meant. Then he smiled thinly. Don't think I'm going to pay the fellow £5,000 out of my own pocket. Not a chance. I don't think anything of the kind, and you know I don't. And I shall be obliged if you won't exercise your very deficient sense of humor on me. Ashenden shrugged his shoulders. And now, recalling the conversation, he shrugged them again. They were all like that. They desired the end, but hesitated at the means. They were willing to take advantage of an accomplished fact, but wanted to shift on to someone else the responsibility of bringing it about. Ashenden entered the café on the Hôtel de Paris and saw Herr Bartus seated at a table facing the door. He gave the little gasp that is forced from you when you dive into water that's colder than you expected. There was no escape. He must make the decision. Herr Bartus was drinking a glass of tea. His heavy, clean-shaven face lit up when he saw Ashenden, and he stretched out a large, hairy hand. It was a big, dark fellow, of a powerful build, with fierce black eyes. Everything about him suggested a massive strength. He was hampered by no scruples, and since he was disinterested, he was ruthless. "Well, how did your dinner go off?" he asked as Ashenden sat down. "Did you say anything to the ambassador about our project?" "No. I think you were wise. It's best to leave those sort of people out of serious matters." Ashenden looked at Herr Bartus for a minute reflectively. His face bore a singular expression, and he sat warily like a tiger about to spring. "Have you ever read Balzac's Père Goriot?" asked Ashenden suddenly. 20 years ago, when I was a student." "Do you remember that conversation between Rastignac and Vautrin, where they discussed the question, whether were you able by a nod to effect the death of a mandarin in China and so bring yourself a colossal fortune? You would give the nod?" "It was a notion of Rousseau's." Herr Bartus's large face coiled itself into a slow, large smile. "It has nothing to do with the case. You are uneasy at giving an order that will cause the death of a considerable number of people. Is it for your own profit? When a general orders in advance, he knows that so and so many men will be killed. It's war." "What a stupid war. It will give my country freedom." "What will your country do when it gets it?" Herr Bartus didn't answer. He shrugged his shoulders. "I warn you that if you do not take this opportunity, it may not recur very soon. We cannot send a messenger over the frontier every day of the week." "Doesn't it make you a little uncomfortable to think of all those men being suddenly blown to smithereens by an explosion? And then it's not only the dead, it's the maimed." "I don't like it. I said to you that on account of my fellow countrymen, who will be sacrificed, we should do nothing unless it was worthwhile. I do not want those poor fellows to be killed, but if they are, I shall not sleep less soundly nor eat my dinner with less appetite. Will you?" "I suppose not." "Well then." Ashenden thought on a sudden of those sharp-pointed stars on which for a moment his eyes had rested as he walked through the frosty night. It seemed an age since he had sat in the spacious dining room at the embassy and listened to Sir Herbert Witherspoon's story of his successful, wasted life. Mr. Sheffer's susceptibilities and his own small intrigues, the love of Byring and Rose Auburn, how unimportant. Man, with so short a time between the cradle and the grave, spent his life in foolishness. A trivial creature. The bright stars shone in the cloudless sky. "I'm tired. I can't think with any clearness. I must go in a minute. Then let's toss for it, shall we? Toss? Yes, said Ashton, taking a coin out of his pocket. If it comes down heads, tell your man to go ahead. And if it comes down tails, tell him to do nothing. Very well. Ashton balanced the coin on his thumbnail and flicked it neatly into the air. They watched it spin, and when it fell back on the table, Ashton put his hand over it. They both leaned forward to look as Ashton very slowly withdrew his hand. Herbartus drew a deep breath. Well, that's that, said Ashton. Chapter 14. A Chance Acquaintance. When Ashton went on deck and saw before him a low-lying coast and a white town, he felt a pleasant flutter of excitement. It was early, and the sun had not long risen, but the sea was glassy and the sky was blue. It was warm already, and one knew that the day would be sweltering. Vladivostok. It really gave one the sensation of being at the end of the world. It was a long journey that Ashton had made from New York to San Francisco, across the Pacific in a Japanese boat to Yokohama, then from Tsuruki in a Russian boat, he, the only Englishman on board, up the Sea of Japan. From Vladivostok, he was to take the Trans-Siberian to Petrograd. It was the most important mission that he had ever had, and he was pleased with the sense of responsibility that it gave him. He had no one to give him orders, unlimited funds, he carried in a belt next to his skin, bills of exchange for a sum so enormous that he was staggered when he thought of them. And though he had been set to do something that was beyond human possibility, he didn't know this and was prepared to set about this task with confidence. He believed in his own astuteness. Though he'd both esteem and admiration for the sensibility of the human race, he had little respect for their intelligence. Man has always found it easier to sacrifice his life than to learn the multiplication table. Ashton didn't much look forward to 10 days on a Russian train, and in Yokohama he'd heard rumors that in one or two places bridges had been blown up and the line cut. He was told that the soldiers, completely out of hand, would rob him of everything he possessed and turn him out on the steppe to shift for himself. It was a cheerful prospect. But the train was certainly starting, and whatever happened later, and Ashton had always a feeling that things never turned out as badly as you expected, he was determined to get a place on it. His intention, on landing, was to go at once to the British consulate and find out what arrangements had been made for him. But as they neared the shore, and he was able to discern the untidy and bedraggled town, he felt not a little forlorn. He knew but a few words of Russian. The only man on the ship who spoke English was the purser, and though he promised Ashton to do anything he could to help him, Ashton had the impression that he must not too greatly count upon him. It was a relief, then, when they docked, to have a young man, small and with a mop of untidy hair, obviously a Jew, come up to him and ask if his name was Ashton. Mine is Benedict. I'm the interpreter at the British consulate. I've been told to look after you. We've got you a place on the train tonight. Ashenden's spirits went up. They landed. The little Jew looked after his luggage and had his passport examined, and then, getting into a car that waited for them, they drove off to the consulate. I've had instructions to offer you every facility, said the consul. And you've only got to tell me what you want. I fixed you up all right on the train, but God knows if you'll ever get to Petrograd. Oh, by the way, I've got a traveling companion for you. He's a man called Harrington, an American, and he's going to Petrograd for a firm in Philadelphia. He's trying to fix up some deal with the provisional government. What's he like? Asked Ashton. Oh, he's all right. I wanted him to come with the American consul to luncheon, but they have gone for an excursion in the country. You must get to the station a couple of hours before the train starts. There's always an awful scrimmage, and if you're not there in good time, someone will pinch your seat. The train started at midnight, and Ashenden dined with Benedict at the station restaurant, which was, it appeared, the only place in that slatternly town where you could get a decent meal. It was crowded. The service was intolerably slow. Then they went on to the platform, where, though they had still 2 hours to spare, there was already a seething mob. Whole families, sitting on piles of luggage, seemed to be camped there. People rushed to and fro or stood in little groups violently arguing. Women screamed. Others were silently weeping. Here, two men were engaged in a fierce quarrel. It was a scene in indescribable confusion. The light in the station was wan and cold, and the white faces of all those people were like the white faces of the dead waiting, patient or anxious, distraught or penitent for the judgment of the last day. The train was made up, and most of the carriages were already filled to overflowing. When at last Benedict found that in which Ashenden had his place, a man sprang out of it excitedly. "Come in, sit down," he said. "I've had the greatest difficulty in keeping your seat. A fellow wanted to come in here with a wife and 2 children. My consul has just gone off with him to see the station master." "This is Harrington," said Benedict. Ashenden stepped into the carriage. It had 2 berths in it. The porter stowed his luggage away. He shook hands with his traveling companion. Mr. John Quincy Harrington was a very thin man of somewhat less than middle height. He had a yellow, bony face with large, pale blue eyes, and when he took off his hat to wipe his brow, wet from the perturbation he had endured, he showed a large, bald skull. It was very bony, and the ridges and protuberances stood out disconcertingly. He wore a bowler hat, a black coat and waistcoat, and a pair of striped trousers, a very high white collar, and a neat, unobtrusive tie. Ashenden didn't know precisely how you should dress in order to take a 10 days' journey across Siberia, but he could not but think that Mr. Harrington's costume was eccentric. He spoke with precision in a high-pitched voice, and in an accent that Ashenden recognized as that of New England. In a minute, the station master came accompanied by a bearded Russian, suffering evidently from profound emotion, and followed by a lady holding 2 children by the hand. The Russian, tears running down his face, was talking with quivering lips to the station master, and his wife, between her sobs, was apparently telling him the story of her life. When they arrived at the carriage, the altercation became more violent, and Benedict joined in with his fluent Russian. Mr. Harrington did not know a word of the language, but being obviously of an excitable turn, broke in and explained in voluble English that these seats had been booked by the consuls of Great Britain and the United States respectively, and though he didn't know about the King of England, he could tell them straight, and they could take it from him, that the President of the United States would never permit an American citizen to be done out of a seat on a train that had been duly paid for. He could yield to force, but to nothing else, and if they touched him, he would register a complaint with the consul at once. He said all this, and a great deal more, to the station master, who, of course, had no notion what he was talking about, but with such emphasis and a good deal of gesticulation made him, in reply, a passionate speech. This roused Mr. Harrington to the utmost pitch of indignation, for shaking his fist in the station master's face, his own pale with fury, he cried out, "Tell him I don't understand a word he says, and I don't want to understand. If the Russians want us to look upon them as a civilized people, why don't they talk a civilized language? Tell him that I am Mr. John Quincy Harrington, and I'm traveling on behalf of Messrs. Crew and Adams of Philadelphia, with a special letter of introduction to Mr. Kerensky, and if I'm not left in peaceful possession of this carriage, Mr. Crew will take the matter up with the administration in Washington." Mr. Harrington's manner was so truculent, and his gesture so menacing, that the station master, throwing up the sponge, turned on his heel without another word and walked moodily away. He was followed by the bearded Russian and his wife, arguing heatedly with him, and the 2 apathetic children. Mr. Harrington jumped back into the carriage. "I'm terribly sorry to have to refuse to give up my seat to a lady with 2 children, he said, No one knows better than I the respect due to a woman and a mother, but I've got to get to Petrograd by this train if I don't want to lose a very important order, and I'm not going to spend 10 days in a corridor for all the mothers in Russia." "I don't blame you," said Ashton. "I'm a married man, and I have 2 children myself. I know that traveling with your family is a difficult matter, but there's nothing that I know to prevent you from staying at home. When you're shut up with a man for 10 days in a railway carriage, you can hardly fail to learn most of what there is to know about him. And for 10 days, for 11 to be exact, Ashington spent 24 hours a day with Harrington. It is true that they went into the dining room 3 times a day for their meals, but they sat opposite to one another. It is true that the train stopped for an hour, morning and afternoon, so that they were able to have a tramp up and down the platform, but they walked side by side. Ashenden made acquaintance with some of his fellow travelers, and sometimes they came into the compartment to have a chat, but if they only spoke French or German, Mr. Harrington would watch them with assiduous disapproval, and if they spoke English, he would never let them get a word in. For Mr. Harrington was a talker. He talked as though it were a natural function of the human being, automatically, as men breathe or digest their food. He talked not because he had something to say, but because he could not help himself, in a high-pitched, nasal voice, without inflection, at one dead level of tone. He talked with precision, using a copious vocabulary and forming his sentences with deliberation. He never used a short word when a longer one would do. He never paused. He went on and on. It was not a torrent, for there was nothing impetuous about it. It was like a stream of lava pouring irresistibly down the side of a volcano. It flowed with a quiet and steady force that overwhelmed everything in its path. Ashton thought he'd never known as much about anyone as he knew about Mr. Harrington. And not only about him, with all his opinions, habits, and circumstances, but about his wife and his wife's family, his children and their schoolfellows, his employers and the alliances they had made for 3 or 4 generations with the best families in Philadelphia. His own family had come from Devonshire early in the 18th century, and Mr. Harrington had been to the village where the graves of his forebears were still to be seen in the churchyard. He was proud of his English ancestry, but proud too of his American birth, though to him, America was a little strip of land along the Atlantic coast, and Americans were a small number of persons of English or Dutch origin whose blood had never been sullied by foreign admixture. He looked upon the Germans, Swedes, Irish, and the inhabitants of Central and Eastern Europe, who for the last 100 years have descended upon the United States, as interlopers. He turned his attention away from them as a maiden lady who lived in a secluded manor might avert her eyes from the factory chimneys that had trespassed upon her retirement. When Ashenden mentioned a man of vast wealth who owned some of the finest pictures in America, Mr. Harrington said, "I've never met him. My great-aunt Maria Penn Warmington always said his grandmother was a very good cook. My great-aunt Maria was terribly sorry when she left her to get married. She said she never knew anyone who could make an apple pancake as she could." Mr. Harrington was devoted to his wife, and he told Ashenden, at unbelievable length, how cultivated and what a perfect mother she was. She had delicate health and had undergone a great number of operations, all of which he described in detail. He had had 2 operations himself, one on his tonsils and one to remove his appendix, and he took Ashenden day by day through his experience. All his friends had had operations, and his knowledge of surgery was encyclopedic. He had 2 sons, both at school, and he was seriously considering whether he would not be well advised to have them operated on. It was curious that one of them should have enlarged tonsils, and he was not at all happy about the appendix of the other. They were more devoted to one another than he had ever seen 2 brothers be, and a very good friend of his, the brightest surgeon in Philadelphia, had offered to operate on both together so that they should not be separated. He showed Ashenden photographs of the boys and their mother. The journey of his to Russia was the first time in their lives that he'd been separated from them, and every morning he wrote a long letter to his wife telling her everything that had happened and a good deal of what he'd said during the day. Ashton watched him cover sheet after sheet of paper with his neat, legible, and precise handwriting. Mr. Harrington had read all the books on conversation and knew its technique to the last detail. He had a little book in which he noted down the stories he heard, and he told Ashton that when he was going out to dinner, he always looked up half a dozen so that he should not be at a loss. They were marked with a G, if they could be told in general society, and with an M for men, if they were more fit for rough masculine ears. He was a specialist in that particular form of anecdote that consists in narrating a long, serious incident, piling detail upon detail, till a comic end is reached. He spared you nothing, and Ashton, foreseeing the point long before it arrived, would clench his hands and knit his brows in the strenuous effort not to betray his impatience, and at last force from his unwilling mouth a grim and hollow laugh. If someone came into the compartment in the middle, Mr. Harrington would greet him with cordiality. "Come right in and sit down. I was just telling my friend a story. You must listen to it. It's one of the funniest things you ever heard." Then he would begin again from the very beginning and repeat it word for word, without altering a single apt epithet, till he reached the humorous end. Ashton suggested once that they should see whether they could find two people on the train who played cards, so that they might while away the time with a game of bridge, but Mr. Harrington said he never touched cards, and when Ashton, in desperation, began to play patience, he pulled a wry face. "It beats me how an intelligent man can waste time card playing. In all of the unintellectual pursuits I've ever seen, it seems to me that solitaire is the worst. It kills conversation. Man is a social animal, and he exercises the highest part of his nature when he takes part in social intercourse." "There is a certain elegance in wasting time," said Ashton. "Any fool can waste money, but when you waste time, you waste what is priceless. Besides," he added with bitterness, "you can still talk." "How can I talk when your attention is taken up by whether you're going to get a black 7 to put on your red 8? Conversation calls forth the highest powers of the intellect, and if you've made a study of it, you have the right to expect that the person you're talking to will give you the fullest attention he's capable of." He did not say this acrimoniously, but with the good-humored patience of a man who's been much tried. He was just stating a plain fact, and Ashton could take it or leave it. It was the claim of the artist to have his work taken seriously. Mr. Harrington was a diligent reader. He read, pencil in hand, underlining passages that attracted his attention, and on the margin, making in his neat writing, comments on what he read. This he was fond of discussing, and when Ashton himself was reading, and felt on a sudden that Mr. Harrington, book in one hand and pencil in the other, was looking at him with his large pale eyes, he began to have violent palpitations of the heart. He dared not look up. He dared not even turn the page, for he knew that Mr. Harrington would regard this as ample excuse to break into a discourse, but remained with his eyes fixed desperately on a single word, like a chicken with its beak to a chalk line, and only ventured to breathe when he realized that Mr. Harrington, having given up the attempt, had resumed his reading. He was then engaged on a history of the American Constitution in two volumes, and for recreation was perusing a stout volume that purported to contain all the great speeches of the world. For Mr. Harrington was an after-dinner speaker, and he'd read all the best books on speaking in public. He knew exactly how to get on good terms with his audience, just where to put in the serious words that touched their hearts, how to catch their attention by a few apt stories, and finally, with what degree of eloquence, suiting the occasion, to deliver his peroration. Mr. Harrington was very fond of reading aloud. Ashton had had frequent occasions to observe the distressing propensity of Americans for this pastime. In hotel drawing rooms at night after dinner, he'd often seen the father of a family seated in a retired corner and surrounded by his wife, his two sons, and his daughter, reading to them. On ships crossing the Atlantic, he had sometimes watched with awe the tall, spare gentleman of commanding aspect who sat in the center of 15 ladies, no longer in their first youth, and in a resonant voice reading to them the history of art. Walking up and down the promenade deck, he'd passed honeymooning couples lying on deck chairs and caught the unhurried tones of the bride as she read to her young husband the pages of a popular novel. It had always seemed to him a curious way of showing affection. He had had friends who had offered to read to him, and he had known women who had said they loved being read to, but he'd always politely refused the invitation and firmly ignored the hint. He liked neither reading aloud nor being read aloud to. In his heart, he thought the national predilection for this form of entertainment the only flaw in the perfection of the American character. But the immortal gods love a good laugh at the expense of human beings, and now delivered him, bound and helpless, to the knife of the high priest. Mr. Harrington flattered himself that he was a very good reader, and he explained to Ashenden the theory and practice of the art. Ashenden learned that there were two schools, the dramatic and the natural. In the first, you imitated the voices of those who spoke, if you were reading a novel. And when the heroine wailed, you wailed, and when emotion choked her, you choked too. But in the other, you read as impassively as though you were reading the price list of a mail-order house in Chicago. This was the school of Mr. Harrington. In the 17 years of his married life, he had read aloud to his wife and to his sons, as soon as they were old enough to appreciate them, the novels of Sir Walter Scott, Jane Austen, Dickens, the Bronte sisters, Thackeray, George Eliot, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and W.D. Howells. Ashenden came to the conclusion that it was second nature to Mr. Harrington to read aloud, and to prevent him from doing so made him as uneasy as cutting off his tobacco made the confirmed smoker. He would take you unawares. "Listen to this," he would say. "You must listen to this," as though he were suddenly struck by the excellence of a maxim or the neatness of a phrase. "Now just tell me if you don't think this is remarkably well put. It's only three lines." He read them, and Ashenden was willing to give him a moment's attention. But having finished them, without pausing for a moment to take breath, he went on. He went right on and on, in his measured, high-pitched voice, without emphasis or expression. He read page after page. Ashenden fidgeted, crossed and uncrossed his legs, lit cigarettes and smoked them, sat first in one position, then in another. Mr. Harrington went on and on. The train went leisurely through the interminable steppes of Siberia. They passed villages and crossed rivers. Mr. Harrington went on and on. When he finished a great speech by Edmund Burke, he put down the book in triumph. "Now that, in my opinion, is one of the finest orations in the English language. It is certainly a part of our common heritage that we can look upon with genuine pride. Doesn't it seem to you a little ominous that the people to whom Edmund Burke made that speech are all dead?" asked Ashenden gloomily. Mr. Harrington was about to reply that this was hardly to be wondered at, since the speech was made in the 18th century, when it dawned upon him that Ashenden, bearing up wonderfully under affliction as any unprejudiced person could not fail to admit, was making a joke. He slapped his knee and laughed heartily. "Gee, that's a good one," he said. "I'll write that down in my little book. I see exactly how I can bring it in one time when I have to speak at our luncheon club." Mr. Harrington was a highbrow, but that appellation, invented by the vulgar as a term of abuse, he had accepted like the instrument of a saint's martyrdom, the gridiron of St. Lawrence, for instance, or the wheel of St. Catherine, as an honorific title. He gloried in it. "Emerson was a highbrow," he said. "Longfellow was a highbrow. Oliver Wendell Holmes was a highbrow. James Russell Lowell was a highbrow." Mr. Harrington's study of American literature had taken him no further down the years than the period during which those eminent, but not precisely thrilling authors, flourished. Mr. Harrington was a bore. He exasperated Ashenden and enraged him. He got on his nerves and drove him to frenzy. But Ashenden didn't dislike him. His self-satisfaction was enormous, but so ingenious that you could not resent it. His conceit was so childlike that you could only smile at it. He was so well-meaning, so thoughtful, so deferential, so polite, that though Ashenden would willingly have killed him, he could not but own that in that short while he had conceived for Mr. Harrington something very like affection. His manners were exquisite, formal, a trifle elaborate, perhaps. There's no harm in that, for good manners are the product of an artificial state of society, and so can bear a touch of the powdered wig and the lace ruffle. But though natural to his good breeding, they gained a pleasant significance from his good heart. He was ready to do anyone a kindness, and seemed to find nothing too much trouble if he could thereby oblige his fellow man. He was eminently serviable, and it may be that this is a word for which there's no exact translation, because the charming quality it denotes is not very common among our practical people. When Ashenden was ill for a couple of days, Mr. Harrington nursed him with devotion. Ashenden was embarrassed by the care he took of him, and though racked with pain, could not help laughing at the fussy attention with which Mr. Harrington took his temperature. From his neatly packed valise, extracted a whole regiment of tabloids and firmly doctored him. Andy was touched by the trouble he gave himself to get from the dining car the things that he thought Ashenden could eat. He did everything in the world for him, but stopped talking. It was only when he was dressing that Mr. Harrington was silent, for then his maidenly mind was singly occupied with the problem of changing his clothes before Ashenden without indelicacy. He was extremely modest. He changed his linen every day, neatly taking it out of his suitcase and neatly putting back what was soiled. But he performed miracles of dexterity in order, during the process, not to show an inch of bare skin. After a day or two, Ashenden gave up the struggle to keep neat and clean in that dirty train, with one lavatory for the whole carriage, and soon was as grubby as the rest of the passengers. But Mr. Harrington refused to yield to the difficulties. He performed his toilet with deliberation, notwithstanding the impatient persons who rattled the door handle and returned from the lavatory every morning washed, shining, and smelling of soap. Once dressed in his black coat, striped trousers, and well-polished shoes, he looked as spruce as though he had just stepped out of his tidy little red-brick house in Philadelphia, and was about to board the streetcar that would take him down to his office. At one point of his journey, it was announced that an attempt had been made to blow up a bridge and that there were disturbances at the next station over the river. It might be that the train would be stopped and the passengers turned adrift or taken prisoners. Ashenden, thinking he might be separated from his luggage, took the precaution to change into his thickest clothes so that if he had to pass the winter in Siberia, he need suffer as little as necessary from the cold. But Mr. Harrington would not listen to reason. He made no preparations for the possible experience, and Ashenden had the conviction that if he spent 3 months in a Russian prison, he would still preserve that smart and natty appearance. A troop of Cossacks boarded the train and stood on the platform of each carriage with their guns loaded, and the train rattled gingerly over the damaged bridge. Then they came to the station at which they had been warned of danger, put on steam, and dashed straight through it. Mr. Harrington was mildly satirical when Ashenden changed back into a light summer suit. Mr. Harrington was a keen businessman. It was obvious that it would need someone very astute to overreach him, and Ashenden was sure that his employers had been well advised to send him on this errand. He would safeguard their interests with all his might, and if he succeeded in driving a bargain with the Russians, it would be a hard one. His loyalty to his firm demanded that. He spoke of the partners with affectionate reverence. He loved them and was proud of them, but he did not envy them because their wealth was great. He was quite content to work on a salary and thought himself adequately paid. So long as he could educate his boys and leave his widow enough to live on, what was money to him? He thought it a trifle vulgar to be rich. He looked upon culture as more important than money. He was careful of it, and after every meal put down in his notebook exactly what it had cost him. His firm might be certain that he would not charge a penny more for his expenses than he had spent. But having discovered that poor people came to the station at the stopping places of the train to beg, and seeing that the war had really brought them to destitution, he took care before each halt to supply himself with ample small change, and in a shamefaced way, mocking himself for being taken in by such impostors, distributed everything in his pocket. "Of course I know they don't deserve it," he said, "and I don't do it for them. I do it entirely for my own peace of mind. I should feel so terribly badly if I thought some man really was hungry and I'd refuse to give him the price of a meal." Mr. Harrington was absurd, but lovable. It was inconceivable that anyone should be rude to him. It would have seemed as dreadful as hitting a child. And Ashton, chafing inwardly, but with a pretense of amiability, suffered meekly and with a truly Christian spirit the affliction of the gentle, ruthless creature's society. It took 11 days at that time to get from Vladivostok to Petrograd, and Ashton felt that he could not have borne another day. If it had been 12, he would have killed Mr. Harrington. When at last, Ashton tired and dirty, Mr. Harrington neat, sprightly, and sententious, they reached the outskirts of Petrograd and stood at the window looking at the crowded houses of the city, Mr. Harrington turned to Ashton and said, "Well, I never would have thought that 11 days in the train would pass so quickly. We've had a wonderful time. I've enjoyed your company, and I know you've enjoyed mine. I'm not going to pretend I don't know that I'm a pretty good conversationalist. But now we've come together like this, we must take care to stay together. We must see as much of one another as we can while I'm in Petrograd." "I shall have a great deal to do," said Ashton. "I'm afraid my time won't be altogether my own." "I know," answered Mr. Harrington cordially. "I expect to be pretty busy myself, but we can have breakfast together anyway, and we'll meet in the evening and compare notes. It would be too bad if we drifted apart now." "Too bad," sighed Ashton.